There's a rumor that my kids are starting viciously. Yeah. The rumor is that I'm old. Now, I need to hear a boo from the congregation. Boo. I'm not old, right? So we're going to take a poll. And I'm not going to say I'm going to judge, but I'm watching. And I'm going to do what human nature is. How many of you think I'm old? Oh, my goodness. That many? I love you, Faye. And this side over here, y'all are good. This side, going to hell. I may be exaggerating that a little bit. I am at that weird age, like where I feel like I'm more mature than the like I don't get the generation. I told you guys last week I don't understand the language. I know from my kids that I've been diagnosed with brain rot, whatever that means, and and I know that I'm the Sigma dad because I've self-proclaimed that. Bro, just saying. So that's all I know. I'm not even sure if I used that right, but there you go. So things have changed a lot, right? I'm from a different generation. I'm from a generation that kind of got forgotten, but for those of us who remember who we are, we're the latchkey kids. We are the Degrassi High, right? We are Generation X. And I just want to say we're the coolest generation ever. Come on. And if y'all don't like it, I don't know what to tell you. It's God. Take it up with God. He made us the coolest generation. We have the cool things. And I was kind of a weird Generation X. I'm not quite 80s. If you want to know your 80s stuff, Mark and Dan, they are absolutely your pros. And it's I get it from Mark because Mark's like old. I'm not telling you. Like Mark is old. He's older than me. Mark's a couple years older than me. But Dan's like, me and Dan are like 5 minutes apart in age. And Dan, like, he knows 80s stuff. I'm more of a 90s person. I want to tell you where I'm at. I turned 12 in 1988. Right, that's a good year, 1988. That was Milli Vanilli, right? The Roger Rabbit. I want to do it, but my kids are like, don't do it, Dad. Okay, so. Hold on, yeah. Here's the thing. This is like NASCAR. You guys just want me to wreck and get hurt. Let's be honest. And I'm going to. I'm going to bust a hip, but I am at that age that when I bust a hip, well, I can't make fun of Mark no more, all right? No, we're there. I'm there. So I'm with you, brother. I'm with you. I'm praying for you. Your pain is our pain. But I turned 12 in 1988, and here's why it's important, because I think 12 is about that age where you really start noticing the world outside of your home, right? Like before that, your whole world is wrapped around mom, dad, the family, like what's right here. And then at 12, you really start noticing, oh, there's stuff outside. My mom's not cool. My dad's not as cool as I thought he was. And I have to watch how I dress. Like, when I turned 12 is when I first started telling my mom, Mom, please stop buying me corduroy pants. Right? Why? Because it's not going to cut it. Like, I found out that there's this whole other group of people out there, Mom, and they do not dress anything like you do. I need to learn what Dockers are, Bugle Boys, like this kind of stuff. This is what matters, Mom. And so I turned 12 at this age, and I started noticing things, culture, styles, language, right? We all start kind of noticing things change. And you realize that your parents, they're probably outdated. And to be fair, I'm outdated. My kids are not going to disagree with that in the least. It might be the first amen I ever get from my kids. Your dad is outdated. Can I get an amen? All right, amen. All right, but here's the thing. In 1988, man, my generation grew up, we were watching Knight Rider, Airwolf, The A-Team, and Magnum P.I. Come on. David Hasselhoff in a Trans Am, right? Come on. Apache helicopters. Mr. T. Some of y'all know what I'm talking about, right? Pity the fool. Right? Tom Selleck playing Thomas Magnum, private investigator, like for the last 8 years. He was the ideal man's man. Right? He had the perfect life. He had the perfect mustache. And still, as far as mustaches go, Tom Selleck has the Cadillac of mustaches. Like, he has set the bar to an unprecedented level, right? So here's Tom Selleck, this amazing mustache. He's a single bachelor living in a mansion in Hawaii, driving around in a Ferrari, having adventure after adventure. Like, that's ridiculously cool. And my mom's watching lame shows like Dallas, Dynasty, Falcon Crest. All right, some of y'all are like, oh yeah, right? And these shows were rich people with rich people drama, right? They're all, everything's too great. JR's got way too much money, and Bobby's is, yeah, right? We know who shot JR. It was Sue Ellen. I know. I grew up in that generation. I confess it. My mom made us learn these things. But my mom also watched shows that some of us secretly watched, but we wouldn't admit till we're older, like The Golden Girls, right? To be fair, the Golden Girls is where my generation got introduced to Betty White, who is an icon of icons, right? She's America's sweetheart. And so this is what she's watching, a bunch of retired ladies living in Miami, having this great life where everything kind of comes together. But for us, if we weren't watching adventure, my generation was watching Family Ties with Kirk Cameron, right? Come on. The Leonardo DiCaprio. Y'all remember how that was a long time ago? Like, who is this fool? Growing Pains with the legendary Michael J. Fox. I'm just saying, that was good stuff right there. And who's the boss? And here's why I got to bring this up, because it's not about Tony Danza. It is not. Not for guys in my generation. In my generation, that is where every one of us fell in love with and started our first obsession with Alyssa Milano. Come on, admit it. It's true. Truth. Oh, my goodness. All these things, I say all this because all this is actually what our world had been consuming throughout the 1980s. It's what we grew up on. They were entertaining. They were over the top. But here's the thing, they were not representative at all of reality. They weren't. None of it. From Falcon Crest, Dynasty, even Airwolf. I was never going to fly an Apache helicopter upside down in some mission. And it turns out that driving that van that B.A. Baracus drove, while cool looking, does not automatically make you tough and cool and able to tell people, I pitted a fool, right? But in 1988, things started to actually shift for my generation. There was this huge cultural shift. In 1988, I personally was introduced to this new TV show that was a total change from the idealisms of the typical 80s TV. Whether it be idealisms about having too much money and money can solve it, or being able to fight your way out of anything, or even the perfect family where your dad's always going to fix everything in 24 minutes. But instead, I got introduced to this show called Roseanne. And Roseanne, yeah, some of you know what I'm talking about, right? Because Roseanne was about this family in Illinois, in Lanford, Illinois, right? This make-believe town. And it was this first show that portrayed just an average working-class family in America. And it was obviously situational comedy, but here's why it mattered, why I think it worked. Because the backdrop for Roseanne, where a woman had to work and a man had to work just to barely make ends meet, and your kids, even though they might start, remember original Becky, right? Original Becky, straight-A student, but, you know, then finding a boyfriend, and sometimes you have this one person to be great, but things happen, right? Life does things, and things shift, and they change, and you never can predict anything. This show that was situational comedy was at least had this backdrop that was real to me. And I think it was real to the 36 million people who tuned in during that first season. Because all these other shows that we watched, all of them, like, I loved watching them because I could escape my world. I could pretend to be Michael Knight. I could pretend to have this car that was going to follow me, pretend that I was going to talk in a watch. To be fair, that one came true. Like, we all talk to our watches now. It's kind of weird. I see you guys doing this, and I'm expecting Kit to come driving up. Nothing happens, right? That would be cool. So if Apple can do that, I will officially become an Apple person, right? As soon as they get the car coming. But these things weren't real. It wasn't my life. It was a way for me to escape my life. And because I saw this on TV, and it's what I saw on every show, I actually thought that I was the only person whose life wasn't like that. I thought that everybody had the life like the Keatons or like the whoever it was on Growing Pains, right? I thought everybody's life was like that, where they had the dad who always figured it out and the mom and everything was funny and a joke and everybody got along and everything worked wonderfully. And everybody had this nice middle-class house and everybody had this. I thought I was the odd man out. And then this show Roseanne comes on and I'm watching this and I'm realizing, okay, these people, at least, they're portraying something that's more realistic to my life, that sometimes life sucks. And that sometimes things just don't work and your family struggles and you have an idea and it doesn't work. Dan doesn't get the drywall business. And then they bail on him. He tries to get the motorcycle shop. Remember that? And that fails on him. And he goes back and Roseanne is trying to work at a plastic factory. And then we get introduced to Booker, right? Clooney. That's where Clooney got started. Remember that when Clooney was dating Aunt Jackie? Oh my goodness. Some of y'all remember. Some of y'all are old. I'm just saying. Okay. But this was more real. And I think that there was this major shift happening in America during that time. Because the 1990s really became this hinge decade for Americans as we actually finally started to acknowledge that real life often sucks. Most people don't have Ozzie and Harriet as parents. Most people don't live in a mansion in Hawaii They don't fly F-14s or drive bulletproof cars into the sunset at the end of the day. I started to realize, like I did, that I'm not alone. Other people are watching this, and I'm realizing I might not be the odd man out. This might be more real. Like, there might be something normal about this dysfunction that is my world. And the 90s really opened that up in everything that you see. See, for me, Roseanne was a way of feeling normal. Like, I wasn't alone in being poor. Like, I wasn't alone in facing unrest or uncertainty or just being different than other people. Dan Connor, man, he kind of became the father that I thought was cool, the one I wanted to be. He was real, he loved his family, but he tried to act tough, right? Like, he was always the tough guy, but at the end of the day, he was a marshmallow, right? He loved his family, he'd do anything. I remember when Aunt Jackie was abused by her boyfriend, what did Dan do? Dan just went over there and whooped him. Man, beat the tar out. Of course, he went to jail, because that's what happens when you beat people up. And this was stuff, even the abuse, the domestic violence, the smart aleckness to kind of hide from the reality of life, the poverty, this is stuff that was real to so many of our lives. And so recently I went back and started watching The Conners, which is kind of the comeback, right? It's the 20 years later show or whatever. I just started it, and it's I admit I'm hooked. I watch too much TV. It starts off where Roseanne dies of an opioid overdose. And Dan is still trying to hold his family together while they face situations that are common to regular families in America every single day. Dan's already dealing with Becky getting pregnant. By the way, we got original Becky back. That's cool, right? Because one day this other person shows up like, you're not Becky, I can't do this anymore. That was weird for my generation. But Becky gets pregnant, she's fighting alcoholism, and there's a scene where she gets onto him. And this one really, really struck me. She gets onto Dan for interfering with her life. She says, I'm an adult. You can't keep interfering with my life, because he tries to stop her from getting a job as a bartender. And she tells him, and I love this, she says, Dad, it's okay that you're not going to be able to save us every time. She says, I'm working hard to stay sober, but I have to live with uncertainty. And because you love me, you have to live with it too. And he responds to her. He says, see, if I'm worried about it, then I have to try to fix it, because that's the one thing that I know how to do, fix things. And this resonated with me. And I pride myself that I could fix anything. And I always want to fix things. If it's broken, I want to fix it. As a dad, for sure, I want to fix things for my babies. When anything's wrong with them, no matter what it is, I want to fix it. But even as a pastor, whenever I see things wrong with my people, I'm not gonna lie, I want to fix it. I just want to fix things. And it's one thing, because it's one thing I feel like I know how to do. I know how to fix things. But the reality is, and this is a hard lesson for us to learn, that it's not always or even usually what is needed or wanted. See, a lot of us deal with this incessant need to fix everything that is broken. Whether it be the dryer, the car, the heart, the mind, the relationship, the problem, whatever. But in real life, we don't get to fix everything in 24 minutes. It doesn't work that way. In fact, in real life, we don't usually even know what's really wrong. We never even figured out. I don't even know what the problem is, so I don't know how to fix this. And most of us, we want to fix the things that we see are broken. I see that thing is broken, and I want to fix it. I want to do right by it. I see this thing. We want to swoop in like the typical hero. We want to identify the enemy, create a plan, execute the plan, and then after fixing everything to our satisfaction, we just want to rejoice because, like Colonel Hannibal Smith would say, I love it when a good plan comes together, right? That's what we want. We all want that. We also know, because I hope we know, that in real life, it rarely, if ever, actually works that day. It doesn't work like that. In fact, many times, we try to fix other people's problems. What happens is, we just find ourselves frustrated because the plan failed. And let's be honest, I think everybody in this room has done that. I just wanted to fix this problem for them, and it didn't work, and it may have even gotten worse, or it may have pulled us apart, or it may have just kept things going, but like, I just wanted this to work, and when it didn't, we were so frustrated. I know I'm not the only one who loses his Jesus, if you will, when things don't go the way I want them to go, especially when the plan to help other people doesn't go that way. And even worse, what we do, and we are all guilty of this, when we try to help somebody else and it doesn't work, when that plan doesn't work, we often find ourselves jaded because we can't blame us and we can't blame our plan. The plan was good. I was right. I saw the problem. I created the plan. I tried to execute it. This is what needed to happen. But you know why it didn't work? Because of you. You didn't follow my plan the way I designed it. I told you if you would do this, it'd get fixed. I told you if you just do that, it'd get better. I told you if you just do that. And so we get mad at people. We get jaded by them. I'm tired of helping people because they don't even listen to my advice. They don't listen to what I'm talking to a wall and you're not doing what I told you to do. If you just do what I said, it would have worked. And we all do that. If it didn't work, it was their fault. They should have just followed the plan. And this is typical. It's typical of the way that humans have tried to fix each other's problems for thousands and thousands of years. It's the one way we keep trying to do it. We keep trying to do the same thing again, and it doesn't work. Right? That's stupid. I think that's a definition of stupidity, not insanity. I think it's a definition of stupidity. It is stupid to keep doing the same thing and expect different results. Right? It's going to hurt. If I take a hammer and I keep hitting me on the hand, it's not going to stop hurting my hand. It's going to hurt every time. I know I keep doing it. I'm stupid sometimes. We can't keep saying, look, if you just follow my plan, it's going to work. It doesn't work that way in real life. It has never worked that way. And it's left us jaded. It's left us frustrated. And it's left so many of us feeling like we simply need, here's what we need to do, is I just need to force others to participate in my plan for their own good. We get to the point where my plan is not the problem. I'm not the problem. They are. And so if they won't listen to me, then for their own good, I'm going to force them to listen to them. I'm going to make them listen to me. They're going to have to listen to me. We even call things like tough love. Like, I'm going to make you do what I need you to do. And let's be very realistic about this, because this exactly is how dictatorships get started. I'm doing this because I need to help my people, and they won't listen to me. They need me to tell them how to do it. They're too dumb to do it on their own. They're not capable. They don't listen. They're hard-headed. They're burros. Whatever it is you want to call them, I need them to listen. And so we're just going to force them to listen against the pains of punishment if they don't. You either do what I say, or I'm going to punish you. And so we begin these ideas of dictatorships, and we try to force people to do it, and it doesn't work because we keep thinking that the problem is with them and not with our plan. You see, here's the thing. The method is what's broken. It doesn't work. And it doesn't work because it's built upon the presumption that we know the problem and we also know the solution, which means that this is built on our pride, not on our love for another person, even if we think it is. And so the scriptures teach us about the importance of love. So in Corinthians, it says, if I speak in the tongues of mortals and of angels, but I don't have love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. Like, I'm just making noise. I'm not doing anything good. I'm just making noise. And if I have prophetic powers, I understand all the mysteries, all the knowledge. If I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but I don't have love, I'm nothing. Like, it doesn't matter how many PhDs I have. It doesn't matter how many seminars I've been to. It doesn't matter how many days of church I've gone to in a row without missing a day or how much I tithe. It doesn't matter who I know, what I know, anything about that. It doesn't matter if I have such faith that I can walk up to people, touch them, and they fall down all healed. That doesn't matter, because if I have love, it's meaningless. It means nothing. If I give away all my possessions, if I hand over my body so that I can boast, I don't have love. I gain nothing. I've accomplished nothing by doing this. See, it doesn't matter how educated you are. It doesn't matter how handy you are. It doesn't matter how hard you're willing to work. If you do not have godly love for another person, you're going to gain nothing. And really, you're just going to cause more frustration in an already frustrating situation. I mean, how many of us have been there? In good intentions, we're trying to help people. We take this situation, we try to do something. What happens? We just make it worse. We keep stepping in. We keep opening our mouths. Remember the old saying, if you find yourself in a hole, stop digging. I can't stop digging. I just want to get a bigger shovel. And I genuinely believe, that most of us, most people in this world, they want to work from a place of love. That we have good intentions when we try to fix things and solve problems. We have good intentions when we tell people, just do it this way. But love, true love for another, is different than that. It does something different in us and through us. This is why Paul continues in Corinthians, and he describes love. He says, here's what it looks like. First off, love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It's not irritable or resentful. Do you see this? This explanation removes the self-focus from love and it shifts it to others. This is why Jesus tells us this is the greatest commandment. They say, all right, Jesus, what's the greatest commandment? Like the Bible's got all kinds of laws. You guys have read that book. It's got more laws and rules than you can shake a stick at, right? There's 613 Jewish laws that he gives them. How many of y'all know them? Come on, somebody. Bobby, you know them all? I know you do, Bobby. Okay, who knows the Ten Commandments? Right? Like, all right, Dan. Of course Dan does. Right, yeah, no. Right, and some of us do, but here's the thing. That's a lot of stuff to learn. So tell me, Jesus, like, I don't know if I can do them all. Is there, like, some way to sum this up? He's like, yeah, actually there is.
Really?
Yeah. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and spirit, and love your neighbor as yourself. That's it. That's the entire commandment. You see, that's the lens by which we see everything. If I got this relationship with God, I love God, I'm in a right relationship, he'll fill me with the Spirit, so I'll have this true love. I'll understand who I am in relation to him and why he is doing all of this and how this love manifests. And then because of that, and this isn't like a second thing to it, it's the other side of the same coin. You can't have one without the other. I'm going to love my neighbor as myself. I'm going to start looking at others and I'm going to be concerned for their sake and not for mine. Like, I want them to have good. I want you to be right. I want you to have this wonderful thing. It shifts the importance from me to God and to others. It's not about me. It's about him. It's about others. And on purpose. I want that. It's not about my plan or my perspective. It's about yours. It doesn't tell the person what's wrong with them. And here's where we struggle. I know I do. We want to diagnose the situation. We have to. Why? Because, man, doctor can't do anything until he diagnoses it. I've seen enough episodes of House and ER to know that. Right? You have to diagnose the situation. So what's the first thing we do? Well, let's figure out what the problem is. Let me tell you what I've diagnosed is wrong with you. Because we want to hurry up and get to the execute plan. We want to hurry up, figure out a solution, make this plan happen, and ride off into the sunset in a really cool car. And so we tell people, here's what's wrong with you. Here's what you need to do. Here's what I would do if it was me. We might even phrase it that way. That way we feel better about it. But it doesn't tell the person. See, love does not tell the person what's wrong with them. Love invites them, in all sincerity, to tell me where you're bleeding from. He listens. How many of us start with that? Tell me where you're bleeding from. I think everybody in this room is bleeding. We've all been bleeding, and some of us are bleeding from different places. Some of us are bleeding, and we don't even know where we got the wounds from. We just know that we're bleeding out. But we live in a world where everybody is bleeding. And everybody tells everybody, well, here's why you're bleeding. Here's how to fix that. And instead, we need to just stop because love isn't arrogant, it's not boastful, it doesn't insist on its own way, it's not irritable, it's not resentful. It invites the question, tell me where you're bleeding from, and then it listens. This is the part. I'm going to listen to you and I'm going to hear you because you're the one who's bleeding and you're the one whose voice matters most in all of this. And I get it because I struggle with that. How many of us here are bleeding? I see it from so many people. I'll be honest with you. It breaks my heart.
And I confess to you that it's my nature, it's who I am. I just want to stop the bleeding. I want to fix the problem. That's what I want to do. But that's for me. But if I do this, I'm only going to add wounds. I'm only going to make it worse. I'm only going to add wounds if I don't stop my selfish impulse and instead just ask, where are you bleeding from? How can I help? What can I do? You tell me. Instead of trying to devise a plan and convince the other to participate in it, listen, friends, we might do better to ask them what it is that they need in that moment. And I get it, because I'm all about the holistic solution. Like, we got to fix the big arching problem. My OCD makes it impossible for me to just do a simple task without saying, well, this means that I've got to do this, I've got to do this, I've got to do this, and I've got to do this. Oh my goodness. Cleaning my yard one day led to me shampooing my carpet because I had to get rid of some wood. A piece of wood is what it was. I was going to throw this piece of wood away. And then I decided I had a use for this wood. And I had to shampoo my carpets because I needed this wood before I wanted to use it to bring up the middle of my chair, because it was you know, what do you call it? No, it was sinking. Sagging, that's the word, it was sagging. I was like, what's a cholo thing? They're sagging, right? Okay, so it was sagging, right? So my couch was sagging in the middle, which normally you wouldn't notice, but it was enough that when Lemmy, my vacuum cleaner, would go under, he'd get stuck. It was frustrating, right? And so I wanted to put that piece of wood under there to lift it up. So I was like, that's gonna be brilliant. I gotta just cut this piece of wood, put it under there. And so I was gonna do that, but then I thought, well, I gotta put it in there and I gotta put it on there right. I wanna make sure that it stays, so I don't want Lemmy to hit it and knock it out. So to do that, I had to pull the couch out, turn it upside down, and then I had to reframe the couch a little bit to add some supports to it so I could put the wood on there. But as I had the couch out, I realized, you know what, this might be a good time to clean back there. So I got to cleaning, and then I started to shampoo that spot. And I thought, if I'm just gonna shampoo this spot, I really need to do the entirety of the carpet. And so there I was doing this entire carpet, shampooing it. And I remember Perla, my friend's calling me later that day saying, hey, what are you doing? I said, I'm shampooing the carpet. She says, I thought you were just going to throw some wood away. I said, I was. I'm still working on that. I'm trying to get rid of the wood, but I got to shampoo the carpet first. So I'm finishing the carpet. That way I could put the stuff on the couch, put it down, get rid of the wood, and have that little spot in the backyard cleaned up, right? This is what we do. We just, one thing leads to another, to another, to another. We want to solve the holistic issue, the big issue. And we're so busy doing this to each other, that same ridiculous, obsessive mentality with each other, that by the time we get to even coming up with a plan, the person we're trying to help is already bled out. And then we get frustrated at them because they didn't wait on us or they sought help somewhere else. See, but this is the reality of it. Instead of devising a plan, instead of trying to convince others to participate in it, say, hey, what do you need in this moment? And then I say, you know what I need? I need a tourniquet. I need something right now. I'm hungry. I need to be fed right now. Well, you don't need food. You need a job. You know, yeah, that's fine. Maybe he needs a job. Right now he needs food. I need some medical assistance. Well, you need health insurance, which means you need to get a job, you need to get a blog, you need to get your life together. You're right, maybe that all needs to happen, but right now they just need someone to help them. We need to start working also in the immediate, and we've become such a society of looking to this giant thing that we're always trying to solve this overarching problem. We never help anybody, and all we do is get mad at each other and blame each other because nothing's getting done. Consider this, that maybe that person doesn't need you to solve their overarching problem. They just need you to stop them from bleeding out. They might need something as simple as you just sitting next to them while they vent. They might need help paying their bills. They might need you to hold them while they cry so that they know they're not alone. Love realizes that only when you follow God, when you look to them. And it realizes that they can only tell you, only they can tell you where they're bleeding from. And only they can tell you where they need that tourniquet. And this is where we struggle. Well, I need this. No, you don't. You really need this. Sometimes people just need a tourniquet, and you need to listen to them and just do it. Stop trying to solve the problem and just listen to the person and be there for them. And I get it. As a parent, it's difficult. My kids come to me with some big, giant problem. Like, I want to solve the whole thing because I don't want them to deal with it again. But sometimes your kids need you to just shut up and just be there for them and let them go through something and just know that you're there with them while they're going through it. You ask them, where are you bleeding from? You're not trying to solve the problem. So ask them, where are you bleeding from? Maybe they need a tourniquet. And maybe Maybe you need to know that you can just quit and rest from this battle. Maybe they just need to know that they have the right to stop. Say, you know what, I need a break. I need to just be able to just quit for a little bit. And that is so hard in our world because we push the never quit so much so I don't even think we think about the ridiculousness sometimes of it. I should have took a picture. I left, me and Sienna were driving in New Mexico, and we were looking at signs, and there's this giant sign that said, never give up. It's awesome, right? Never give up. And underneath it, 1-800, quit now. That's our world, right? Like, we can't get away from the idea that maybe it's okay to just quit. Maybe it's okay to just say, you know what? I can't. I need to stop doing that. I need to stop trying to fight that battle. Maybe you need to know you can quit and rest. Maybe you need a tourniquet, right? Sometimes maybe you just need to quit. But what love does is it believes them. It stands by their side regardless of what it is that they tell you they need. It says, if you need this, I'm there. If you need this, I'm there. If you need this, I'm there. Because what you do need to know from me is I'm here. Because it's all that we can do, right? And really, that's about all that people want from us, is to know that we're here, that we're present with them in this situation. We are all muddling through life. But we don't have to muddle through it separately. We don't have to muddle through it alone. I want to invite the team to come back up so that I'll stop. Pastor Josh made a good point about if you're going to stop, just stop. Don't say that, and then 20 minutes later, continue. So you guys can thank Josh. Amen. See, here's the thing. In real life, our problems aren't solved with money or tech or soldiers or any other idealism. In real life, people are bleeding out every single day. And sometimes they don't even know exactly where they're bleeding from. But they feel it and they know that they're wounded. They don't need us to tell them what their problem is. They just need us to have love for them. They need us to ask and to believe them when they tell us what they're feeling and what it is that they're needing. That's love. It's okay to be like Dan Connor and to feel helpless because we can't fix our loved ones' problems. But that's not our role. Your role is not to fix other people's problems. You are not capable of that. Your heart may be in the right place, but you can't do that. Our role is just to love them and to be there for them. We can guide them, we can direct them, we can encourage them, and cry with them and laugh with them, whatever we need to do. One of my favorite more contemporary artists, Zach Bryan. This guy's just amazing. I love him because country music has really turned into the Luke Bryans or whatever of this world. They're just kind of fake and rodeos and talk about trucks and alcohol. But Zach Bryan does a good job, I think, of kind of sharing things that are real in this world. He says in one of his songs, he says, you've been stabbed in the back and the rest of your body. Won't you tell me where you're bleeding from? If you need a tourniquet, or if you want to turn and quit, know that I'll be by your side. You bled your whole soul into things you can't control in a world you'll never satisfy. So I'll bandage up your body and your bones and your bad days too. Take care of the blood that your love runs through. I know all the damage that some days in this dark world does. Your laugh in last week is something I dreamed of. And we do a lot better as Christians if we stop trying to solve problems and spend more time just trying to be there for each other. And if we would just start there, if we just say, you know what, sometimes life sucks, and this person says, I'm having a hard time, then they're not lying, they're having a hard time, just be there. And I'm going to be the first to confess, this is difficult for me. So I'm going to work on it as your pastor, I'm going to work on it as a parent, I'm going to work on it as your friend, as a member of the community, but I pray that we would all do this. That we just be a people who are willing to be there for each other, amen? But here's the other thing, there's a responsibility that falls to you. See, no one can listen to where you're bleeding from if you're not willing to tell them. You have to come in and be willing to make yourself vulnerable. Say, you know what? This is where I'm bleeding. This is where I'm hurting, and this is what I need. Would you rise to your feet? Father, fill us in this time. May we seek, Lord, to cry out to those who are hurting. To the poor, to the powerless, to the lost, to the lonely. That we would confess to each other that we're hurting, that we're bleeding. That we make ourselves vulnerable to others, Father, and that we would hold that trust, the greatest value and integrity. That we would listen and walk together through this life, knowing that that is exactly what you've done for us. We pray this in Jesus' name.